And this is a two-tape series on questions and answers about hair analysis. And I'll quickly run through the questions that we'll address, and then we'll get started answering them. The questions include, how do you get readings from a piece of hair? What is this all about? Also, are the readings reliable and consistent? And are the readings significant, and what do they signify? And how are the readings different from the readings you get on a blood test or a urine test or some other medical test? And why are the readings different if you send the sample off to two or three different laboratories? And why do people send animals' hair off sometimes and get results on that? And why do some hair analysis laboratories recommend vitamins and foods? And how can you tell that since the reading is only a mineral test? And does the reading represent the total body load of a mineral? Or what does it represent? And are there scientific studies on hair analysis? And why do different laboratories have different ranges of normal, and some laboratories use ideals instead of ranges? And what about environmental contamination of the hair, like hair dyes and, you know, working and then getting all sweaty? And what are the disease trends or the research associations that some laboratories send you? And is hair analysis legal and approved and all that kind of thing? And why do different laboratories interpret the test differently? And what does hair analysis have to do with metabolic typing and oxidation types? And what is meant by the mineral system? And how does that relate to a hair analysis? And what does hair analysis have to do with the stress theory of disease and the stages of stress? And why do laboratories report mineral ratios? And why do we pay attention to those? And why do we look at the whole chart and not just, say, aluminum or mercury? And where do people learn about hair analysis? Where can you learn about it? And what's the concept of preferred minerals? And what is the concept of the layers of adaptation mean? Another question is, what are defenders on a hair analysis? And why can't we just use chelating agents to get rid of toxic metals? Why are saunas recommended as particularly helpful? Also, how can you tell emotional patterns from a hair analysis, which some people claim? How can you tell the autonomic balance from a hair analysis, as some people claim? Isn't it better to use foods to fix body chemistry rather than synthetic mineral supplements? How does the interpretation that I'm going to discuss differ from symptomatic nutrition and what we call replacement therapy? How does hair analysis relate to the Chinese medicine concepts of yin and yang? And then there are some other topics. I don't know if I'll get enough time on the tapes to discuss them. And those include things like, how does the mineral therapy, the mineral balancing therapy, differ from, you know, other therapies like fasting and homeopathy, energy medicine, juice therapy, IV vitamin C and glutathione, and so forth. So those are the questions that we will address. Okay, let's get started. How do you get readings from a piece of hair? This is not as hard as it may sound. The test is a standard test. It uses spectroscopy. And basically, hair is a tissue of the body. You could use any tissue. Hair is used because it's easy to sample. It's also an excretory tissue. That means the body's going to get rid of it anyway. So the body deposits things in the hair that it wants to get rid of, and anything it does not want to get rid of, it does not deposit in the hair, you know, essential elements. And so we can tell a lot about how the body is processing things, about metabolism, from hair. And the hair is sent to a laboratory where it is cut up finely. It is dissolved overnight in acid. Some laboratories wash it first, by the way, We'll discuss that later. And then a carefully weighed sample is put into a spectroscopy machine. There are several instruments used. The most common one today is the mass spectroscopy unit. However, other ones are the ICP, that's called an inductively coupled plasma unit, and an older unit is called atomic absorption spectroscopy. Now, those machines basically heat the sample to several thousand degrees, very hot, computer-controlled flames. They're very, very accurately controlled. And then there is a series of detectors that detect the spectrum given off by each mineral. And that is reported in parts per million and the newer machines in parts per billion. Very accurate test, very well-known, very standard test used to measure soil minerals, used to measure rocks, used to measure stars and the, you know, what stars are composed of, all kinds of things, standard tests for minerals, used for animal tissues and all sorts of things. So that's the basic test. It's been around for 75 years. It's only been used for humans in the last 30, say, roughly. And that's how it's done. Now, it has to be done correctly, carefully, no contamination, obviously, and things like that. Hair has to be dissolved properly overnight, and so forth. Next question. Is this test reliable and consistent? Well, there have been many studies done, and you can do the study yourself. You can send off double samples. I've done this to the same laboratory. And as long as you take the hair at the same time and take it from the same area, you can get a pretty reliable idea of how reliable the test is. But in fact, the hair analysis laboratories in the United States are licensed by the government. Every year they are inspected, and they are required to submit blind samples. That is to say, a little vial, it's a liquid, is sent to the lab. They have to run it and send it back. If the results are not correct, the laboratory is shut down. And that happened recently with a hair analysis laboratory. So the reliability and consistency really is not a question. Other people will tell you that. They'll say, oh, it's unreliable because of a study in JAMA, and we're going to discuss those studies. But in fact, the test itself is extremely reliable. I recommend analytical research laboratories for hair analysis for several reasons. They don't wash the hair, and their interpretations are the best, and they do very careful work. But in their case, they use four controls with each batch. That is to say, let's say they run a batch of 100 samples a day. Well, in the beginning, in the middle, several times, and at the end, they will run a control. They'll just put one in there. If those controls do not check out at the end, they throw away the whole batch and they start over. So that's good laboratory procedure. The other laboratories do not do it necessarily as much, but I don't know all their control procedures. But I know that that's how they do it at analytical research labs. And that's good quality control, and you will get consistent results. They ask you for a little extra hair so that if they have a problem, they can run it again. And at analytical research labs, if any number comes out of range, they will retest that number, and they will confirm your reading. And I encourage doctors, if any test number is way out of whack, you can always call the lab and say, did you rerun this sample? Because they should, and usually they will, free of charge. That is not done, by the way, with blood tests, and I don't know that it's done with the other hair analysis labs, but it is done at analytical research laboratories. Okay. Now, what is the significance of these readings? Well, that's a very important question, and later on I'll get into interpretation more, but basically, I'll say this much right now. We are not looking at the total body load of a mineral. You cannot say that because your hair zinc is low, that your body zinc is low. That is not the significance of the test. What the significance of the test is it tells you how the body is responding to stress. In other words, hair is a tissue. The tissue has metabolism. The minerals are part of that metabolism. And there's a lot of research by Hans Selye and other researchers on stress theory on what happens when the body responds to stress in different ways. There's the alarm, resistance, and exhaustion stages of stress. There are metabolic types. These have to do with how the body is responding. This is what we are measuring, not how much zinc do you have and how much mercury do you have. What I find is everybody's got low zinc and everybody's got high mercury and everybody's got high arsenic and everybody's got high lead. The amount varies. Some people have extremely high lead. But that is not so much the significance of the test. You can tell a lot of that. But the real significance is, how is this body responding to stress and how can I help it to respond better? And the way you help it to respond better is you fix it, the diet, you get more rest and sleep, and we can supplement with the nutrients needed in that stage of stress and with the patterns they're showing to help that body respond better, to help it eliminate the metals, to help it replenish the ones that are needed, and make other corrections. Okay. How is hair testing different from blood and urine and other medical tests? Well, the way it's different is it's measuring a different compartment of the body. Urine and blood, of course, are specific compartments of the body. Another difference is urine and blood are instantaneous. Hair tissue is dead, and it takes several months to grow an inch of hair. And so what you're measuring with a hair test, if you measure an inch of hair, is you're measuring an average of the last 3 months of metabolism. Now, this has advantages and it has disadvantages. The advantages are it's not affected by what you ate yesterday. It's not affected by whether you had a good night's sleep or whether you got upset or whether a woman is on her period or many, many other things that will affect the chemistry from day to day. The disadvantages are it will not tell you what's going on at this instant. So, for example, if you go to the emergency room with your heart racing and faint, a hair analysis is not appropriate because it's not going to tell you what's going on in the last hour of your life. So it's important to understand these differences in tests and when to use them. The hair analysis is used to detect deep metabolic patterns. These do not change very much over several months, often over several years, unless you do something to change them. It's a very good test to tell the deeper patterns, for example, metal toxicity. Well, you don't use a hair analysis to detect acute metal toxicity. You can't drink some lead and then take a hair sample and find the lead. That will not happen. You can do that with blood. You can drink some lead and take the blood, and you will find it. The problem with blood tests for toxic metal poisoning, which the EPA found and anyone who thinks about it will find, is that the body does not keep the lead in the blood. Lead is extremely toxic, mercury, aluminum, all these things. And as fast as it can, the body gets it out of there, gets it out of the blood. Where does it put it? It puts it in the tissues. Why? Because it does less damage there, because at least it's not circulating around and touching everything. In the tissues, especially the not essential tissues like the hair, it's less dangerous. So if you drink some lead or some mercury, you will find it in the blood maybe for a few days, maybe even for a few weeks, and then it's gone. Whereas if you look at a hair test, it is a much better indicator of chronic metal toxicity. That's what we're looking at, is chronic toxicity, chronic deficiencies, chronic patterns of all sorts. And that's what these studies show. Okay, so those are some of the differences. There are many other differences. The hair, because it's a tissue test, it tells you things about the site of metabolism. Most metabolism takes place at the cellular level, not in your urine or your blood. Now, this doesn't mean there aren't excellent markers in the blood and urine for all kinds of things, cholesterol and iron and, all the rest of the things that are measured, glucose, that are measured on those tests. Why do people get different results from different hair analysis labs? This is a frequent criticism of hair analysis and was brought out in some studies done in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Well, the answer is the procedures are different. And the procedure that's different is the washing procedure mainly. The instrumentation may vary, but any good instrument will give similar readings. It's not, you know, people say, oh, that laboratory is using ICP and that's an outdated method, or even AA, atomic absorption. That's not true. You can still get good readings from those older instruments. They may not be quite as sensitive, but they worked. What differs is the washing procedure. And that makes a huge difference. And the reason it does is that hair is porous. Hair is 10%, about male hair about 10%, female hair about 15% porous. What that means is that once it's off the head, if you wash it, you will wash out some of the water-soluble elements. This is particularly true at these laboratories because they use powerful chemicals. They don't just use, you know, Johnson's baby shampoo. They're using Triton X, a very powerful detergent, or acetone, a solvent, or alcohol, things you would never use in your shower, for example. When you shower, you wash out a little bit, but it turns out that with the oil glands and the sweat glands and everything, just when you dry the hair and comb it and brush it, it re-equilibrates, and you're not using powerful chemicals, but the laboratories do. Now, all the laboratories, except for two of them, wash the hair. Doctor's Data and Great Smokies, at this time of this tape being made, they use Triton X and acetone, very, very powerful chemicals. Another one of the big labs, King James Laboratory in Cleveland, they use alcohol to wash the hair. Again, very powerful solvent. And not only do they use these chemicals, but they all use different times to wash them. Some of the labs wash for 3 minutes, some for 1 minute, some for 10 minutes. Now what happens is that will wash out the water-soluble elements, sodium and potassium in particular, but there are others to varying degrees. And the weight of the sample is changed. In other words, if you have a sample, you know, 10 things, and you remove two of them, the relative amounts of all the other ones in a perfectly weighted sample is going to be different. So it skews all the readings. All of them. They're all shifted a little bit. Toxic metals are not shifted too much, but the nutrient minerals are shifted a lot more. So you end up with different readings. And this is a problem and an embarrassment for hair analysis, I would say. It's not really that big a deal because if you go into blood laboratories, there are people who use a certain way of doing a blood test, and then there's people who use another way. And you can't really compare them. You just have to know that this laboratory, you know, did the PSA or whatever it was by a certain method, and this lab uses another method, and you get different results. But it's important in hair analysis, because people are so ignorant about it, that you realize that if you use a lab that washes the hair, you get different results. It's not the same test. It's not the same procedure. Now, JAMA featured a study in 1985 by Stephen Barrett, in which he, I would say, explored this fact, and concluded that hair analysis was a fraud. What he did was he took two samples of hair from his daughters, his teenage daughters, who had very long hair. Then he washed them under his kitchen tap. Then he cut the samples up into little pieces, and then he sent it off to six laboratories. And three of them had very good correlation. About another four had poor correlation. Actually, sent it off in those days, there were about 13 laboratories. And some others had poor correlation. Now, he made a lot of mistakes. I don't think they were mistakes. I think they were intentional. I think he was trying to discredit it because he has a website and he's a quack buster and all that kind of thing. But anyway, what he did was he used long hair. Well, that's all the labs will tell you right in their literature, don't use long hair. The sample should be no more than 1 inch long, 1.5 at most, cut from the scalp, because that's new hair. Old hair unravels, you've heard of split ends, and is not as reliable, should never be used. Also, the mineral levels can change because the person's health can change. Then he washed it under the tap. That's not a good idea. The tap water is full of junk, full of all kinds of metals, depending on what your water is. And then you really can't mix hair samples by hand. because they're electrostatic. So that kind of invalidates the study too. All these things invalidate the study. And then he sent it off to different laboratories, some of which wash the hair and some do not. So it's not surprising that he got different answers. Now, in 2001, Seidel and company repeated the Barrett study in a way. They called it, that's what they said. And they did it better. They were aware of some of these errors that I'm pointing out. They mentioned them in the study. It was published in JAMA again. And what they did is they took one woman and they cut six samples off her head at the same time. And they sent it to five or six laboratories. Well, that was better. However, they also concluded that hair analysis was unreliable based on the results. Now, they had a few flaws in their study, and it's important to point these out. I'm not just being critical, but it's important to read these studies, because otherwise you hear about it on TV or someone reads it in Prevention magazine, and they tell you, oh, yeah, that's an unreliable test. That's what it said in JAMA. Well, you have to read the study. What they did was, first of all, they only used one woman. One person. Well, that to me is not a study. I'm shocked that JAMA would consider it a study. It's what I call anecdotal. And this is the thing that the medical profession criticizes the holistic people for all the time, is that their studies are anecdotal. Well, how more anecdotal can you get than to just use one person? It's not an expensive test. They could have used five or six at the very least. But worse than that, they used an illegal lab. And they knew that. They said it in the study. They said one of the laboratories had lost their license and on and on. And yet, they sent it to that lab, and they included it in their data, and they never separated it out. They never said, well, if we included this data, it would show this, and if we left it out. No, they just threw it in with the other data. Not only that, but this illegal lab was smaller than the other labs. In other words, they stated in their article that they wanted to use good-sized labs, you know, so that they would be representing fairly, but then they threw in this illegal one, which was a very small lab. And so to me, I question their motives again in doing that. I can't see why you would do that, why you would include it, why you would not separate it out, and why you would use it since it was a small lab, unless you wanted to discredit hair analysis. And it turns out that if you look at the data, that had the worst data, by far the worst data, by far. If they had left that out, hair analysis would have come out reliable, and probably they wouldn't have gotten their study published. But that's another story. Okay, so anyway, the other thing that is most important about that JAMA study and is worth reading for this reason is that if you only looked at the two laboratories that did not wash the hair, analytical research labs and trace elements, the numbers were practically identical. Six of the nine nutrient minerals were identical. Now that is not only reliability and consistency, it's remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable accuracy. Now, of course, they didn't do that. But if you look at the data, you'll see that. Six out of the nine numbers are identical. The other three are very, very close. So in fact, their own study proved the exact opposite of what they claim in the conclusion. In other words, their own study proves that hair analysis, when done correctly, when you don't wash the hair, meaning when the procedure is done the same way, is extremely reliable, extremely accurate. So much for accuracy and reliability. This brings us to the question, and so this is why the labs differ, and you'll get different results. They're using different procedures. I only recommend the labs that do not wash the hair. Otherwise, I hate to say it, but it's pretty much of a crapshoot. The toxic metals are not bad, but the other stuff is really skewed. Now, some people ask, why do people send animal hair to a hair testing lab? Well, the reason is because it's wonderful. It's a wonderful tool for animals. There aren't a lot of books on the interpretation. The normals vary with each species, so you got to know what you're doing. And I do some interpretations on animals, but not too many people do. But it actually is an excellent test. And that'll bring us to one other popular debunking of hair testing that happened a couple of years ago. It was on Nightline, I think. It was either 48 Hours or Nightline. I think Nightline. What they did was they sent the hair off from a dog, a poodle, to analytical research labs. They didn't tell the lab that it was a dog. They asked for an interpretation. The test came back, and it said the dog was very sick. It was out of range, the numbers were bad, the dog looked like he had thyroid problems, and on and on. And they just, you know, they just blasted this. They just said, look, here's a vet. The vet knows this dog is healthy, and obviously this whole thing's a fraud. Of course, you know, hopefully you've already figured out what's wrong with this. If you took hair from a dog, or let's say you took blood from a dog and sent it to a blood lab, it would also give you totally different information than blood from a human being if you used the human normals. In other words, if you didn't tell the blood lab that you were using a dog, they would just assume that it was a human, and they would use human normals, and the blood test would look terrible. So, obviously, this was only an effort to make hair analysis look ridiculous, which they did, but it has no relation to reality. If you tell a laboratory that you're doing a cat or a dog or horse, there's a lot of research on horses, they will use completely different set of normals, and it has to be interpreted differently for an animal. But it's important to understand these things so that you can answer the question when someone says, well, I saw that on TV and they said it was a bunch of garbage. Yeah, because they were trying to make it look like a bunch of garbage. Okay. Now, something that's claimed by some people, including myself, is that you can tell about vitamin needs and protein needs and carbohydrates from a mineral test, even though the test only reads minerals. How is this possible? Well, the reason is because we are not looking at the total body load of a mineral. Now, some hair analysis do look at, they claim you can do the total body load. I'm telling you, you cannot. You can only tell what's in the hair. What we are looking at is how the body is responding to stress. Now, once we assess how the body is responding to stress, that is the stage of stress, the metabolic type, the autonomic balance, the oxidation rate, which are all related, by the way. They sound like they're all different, but they're not. Then we know a lot about a person, because Dr. Hans Selye, the founder of the stress theory of disease, found, for example, that people in the exhaustion stage of stress, where 80% of Americans are, they need certain nutrients to help them with that stage. They need a lot of vitamin C and vitamin E, and they need manganese and zinc. They do not need certain other nutrients as much, vitamin D, for example, is not as important for those people. Copper is not as important. Usually they have too much copper. So if we know how the body's responding to stress, then we can figure out a lot about diet and other factors. Now, other indicators on the test, like the phosphorus level, tells us about protein synthesis. Well, that's dependent on how much protein you eat. It's dependent on how you digest your protein and what kind of protein and so forth. There are also indicators like the calcium-magnesium ratio is an assessment. A high ratio is associated with hypoglycemia, or really blood sugar intolerance is better, and it has to do with eating too much carbohydrate. So even though we're only measuring minerals, by assessing what the minerals refer to, you can get an idea about vitamins and protein and amino acids and different things. Another example is that if you find a toxic metal, say cadmium, well, we know that there are ways to get cadmium out, and that certain things will help get cadmium out, including sulfur amino acids, including vitamin C, including zinc, including calcium, perhaps selenium. So just from the cadmium reading, we can know about more than just minerals. So that is why it is possible to say that from a hair analysis you can get information about more than minerals. The next question that we'll talk about is, are there studies of hair analysis? And the answer is yes. In 1979, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, reviewed 400 studies of hair analysis. And this document, I've seen it, it's probably still available, it may be out of print. But basically, they concluded that hair is a meaningful and representative tissue for the measurement of toxic metals. They were most interested in toxic metals. So anyone who says there's no studies on hair analysis, we know that they're not really reading. They're not really looking. There aren't a lot of studies in JAMA or the New England Journal of Medicine because they don't get published there. I believe because it threatens a certain paradigm that they work with. Except for these sort of bogus studies that seem to get in there. I hope that'll change soon. But in fact, there are quite a few studies. There aren't a lot of double-blind large studies because those are very expensive. There are a lot of studies on individual minerals. There are a lot of animal studies. There are studies of horses and hair analysis. There are in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition and the Orthomolecular Medical Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine, and many foreign journals, there are studies of hair mineral testing. I did a study in the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine, Volume 1, Number 2, 1986, on determining oxidation rate from hair mineral analysis. So there are studies. The back of my book, Nutritional Balancing and Hair Mineral Analysis, has a number of studies listed. And most hair analysis laboratories, if you ask them, can send you a bibliography of studies. Okay. Now, why do the normal values differ for among hair analysis labs? That's another complaint about hair analysis. The reason for this is partially what we've mentioned earlier, namely that some of the labs wash the hair and some do not. If you wash the hair, your normals are going to be very different. Oddly, this was one of the criticisms in the Seidel study in the Journal of the AMA in 2001. In other words, they were complaining that the normal values were different. Now, what was funny about it, what was odd about it, was that they mentioned they were aware that the procedures varied. They were aware that the labs, some labs washed the hair and some did not. And yet they still complained that the normals were different. Well, of course they're different. You're measuring something different. So that's one major reason for different normal values among a bunch of labs. There are other reasons too, though. All the labs, except for analytical research laboratories, use ranges of normal. Analytical research laboratory uses ideals or normal values. Now, that is a large difference, and it has to do with paradigm differences. The use of ranges, which, as I say, most all the labs do, the standard deviation, one standard deviation, and all that kind of stuff, that is based on the old medical paradigm, the old allopathic paradigm. And that paradigm says you are healthy unless you have a disease, an entity. And if you don't have cancer, and if you don't have diabetes, and you don't have hypothyroidism, you're healthy. Now, if you use that paradigm, that way of thinking, then they run samples on, quote, healthy people, and they come out with this huge range, the bell curve, the usual bell curve. Why? Well, because one person they test really is super healthy. The next person is going to get cancer next week, is going to be diagnosed next week, but we don't know that. The next person after that is going to come down with a heart attack in a month, but we don't know that. You know, and the next person they test is going to be diagnosed with diabetes in a few weeks, but we don't know that. So as a result, their values, their test values are going to vary. That would only make sense. They're not really healthy people, is what I'm really saying. But we call them healthy. The medical system calls them healthy. Now, the use of ideals or normals is a different paradigm. That paradigm is a newer paradigm that's sometimes called wellness. Actually, it's not newer because it is similar. It is more similar to the old acupuncture paradigm and the chiropractic paradigm, where you're looking at ideal or normal things. And in that sense, we're not interested in, you know, what the average American looks like, because those people are not healthy. We are interested in ideals or normals. The concept of wellness is that illness, it's not just about, you're not healthy if you just don't have cancer. Health is a separate entity, so to speak, with its own parameters. And you can have degrees of health, and you can be so healthy that there's no chance of getting cancer, kind of thing. It just won't take hold. Sometimes this is referred to as the concept of the terrain. And so the wellness paradigm is a newer one. It's where we build up the terrain, we build up the values, and we get them to a near perfect or near ideal state. Well, that is the idea of having the ideals or normals on the hair analysis. And that is the method used at analytical research laboratories. Now, the reason that Dr. Paul Ek did that, he is the founder of analytical research labs, is that he realized that the normal ranges were just not useful. And it happens all the time. People bring me a hair analysis done by another laboratory, and they brought it to their doctor, and the doctor said, well, everything looks in normal range, so I guess you're okay, when the person is not okay. They feel terrible. That's because the normals are too wide. The ranges are too wide. So the idea of ideals is actually much better. Dr. Paul Ek used athletes. And, of course, just because you use athletes doesn't mean they're healthy either. We read in the paper every now and then, a couple months, every now and then a great athlete just drops dead. Even a high school athlete, they do this. So they're not all healthy either. But what Dr. Ek did is he worked on these athletes. They were young, healthy athletes, and then he worked on them. He did their programs. He improved their nutrition. He gave them supplements. He did whatever needed. And he saw where they peaked out. He saw where their performance peaked. And that's what he used as his normal values. And those are still changing. Those are still changing. The toxic metal values, for example, I think need to go even lower as we learn more about getting them out of the body and how to get them out. But that's the difference between ranges of normal and ideals. And my preference, which is the reason I prefer analytical research labs, is to use ideals, not ranges. They're too wide. They don't give you enough information. The only two labs, you know, the two labs that don't wash the hair are Trace Elements in Texas and Analytical Research Labs in Phoenix. A little history there. The director of Trace Elements, David Watts, used to work at Analytical Research Labs and trained under Dr. Paul Ek. And then he has gone off and changed a number of concepts, made them more complicated, and I believe mostly needless complication. And so I studied with Dr. Paul Ek for 14 years and was working under him. I do not work for that laboratory. I do not work at the laboratory, but I do consult for them. Okay, next question. What about environmental contamination of hair? Many people criticize hair analysis because they say, well, you know, all you have to do is get your hair dirty and it'll wreck the test. Not to mention tints and dyes and shampoo and all the rest of the things that people put on their hair. What we find in practice is that these products are not that big a problem, and that washing the hair to get rid of dirt and things is much more of a problem. Now, I do recommend that the hair be clean and washed within 48 hours, preferably 24 hours. However, the contamination problem is generally not an issue. Certain hair dyes contain lead. Youth hair and Grecian formula, they're men's hair dyes mostly. And those need to be avoided. And it's good to do a hair analysis because you'll find them and you know that the lead levels are off the scale, way off the scale. And they need to be stopped immediately because you absorb things through the scalp. Celsin Blue Shampoo will raise selenium. Head and Shoulders will raise zinc. There are probably other dandruff shampoos that contain selenium or zinc. And those, you have to watch it. On the selenium, you can become toxic. So if you get an outrageous reading of those things, you know that there may be a hair product involved, and you need to ask the person. But as a general rule, it's not a problem. Swimming in swimming pools will raise copper and sodium. Sometimes it will even double them. But that can be accounted for if someone is a swimmer all the time. Tints and dyes do not contain metals, so they don't affect the test, except for the lead-containing ones that I mentioned. If a person has a bleach or a permanent, then I like them to wash their hair 5 times before they cut, because those treatments damage the hair a little bit. And of course, you can recommend that people get their hair cut for hair sampling before they go for their bleach treatment or their permanent or their dye treatment, whatever. However, as a general rule, the shampoos, the dyes, the tints are not a problem. Actually, most shampoos contain EDTA or other chelating agents, which is why they make your hair feel soft. And in many cases, actually in almost all cases, it's better to do the test. Even if someone has done something horrible to their hair, better to do the test, and it will not be perfect, and get started on a program, then wait a couple months so that it'll be perfect, if you know what I mean. It will not skew it that much, and it's important to get people started, especially if they're not feeling well. And along those lines, I do not recommend pubic hair. Many people say, well, I'll just use pubic hair instead because I tint my hair. No, don't do that. Pubic hair, it does maintain some of the ratios, but a lot of the values are shifted. The phosphoruses are very high. I don't like it. The laboratories tell you you can do that. I would prefer that you not do that. I think you get better information from a hair, head hair sample. If you can't get head hair, then use beard hair or body hair, underarm or chest hair in a man, rather than pubic hair. Pubic hair is my sort of last choice. What are trends on a hair analysis? Sometimes the labs report research associations or disease trends. And why is this different from a diagnosis? This is an important question. A diagnosis in medicine is very specific. For example, for a diagnosis of cancer, you have to have a biopsy. You can't just look at the person or look at a lump on somebody's arm and say, I think you have cancer. That's not a diagnosis. If you want to diagnose diabetes, you need a glucose tolerance test. So that is a very specific thing. Hair analysis is not considered a diagnostic test. It is considered a screening test. And there is a great difference. Screening tests in medicine are undervalued, but they're very important. The definition of a screening test is a test that is generally inexpensive, quick, and gives a lot of information rapidly. From that test, you can then go on and do whatever you need to do. You can do other testing, you can rule things out, you can start treatment, whatever you want to do. But the screening test checks a lot of things quickly. And that's what hair testing does. That's one of the nice things about it. It's extremely inexpensive compared to a lot of tests. And on the report, on an interpretation, they may suggest that there are research trends. Now, the reason it's a trend and not a diagnosis is because we're not diagnosing, first of all. And secondly, what the test measures, is a metabolic pattern, a stress response pattern. And over the years, research has been done, Dr. Pollack did a lot of it, on what mineral patterns are associated with what diseases. So, for example, low chromium, manganese, or zinc are associated with diabetes and hypoglycemia. Why? Because those elements are needed to metabolize glucose. Zinc is needed to produce insulin. It's needed to extend the action of insulin, and it's needed to release insulin. Manganese is needed to burn sugar in the mitochondria. Chromium is needed to attach insulin to cell walls so that the glucose will pass through. If you are deficient in those minerals, you have a trend or a tendency or a research association for hypoglycemic symptoms, diabetic symptoms. Now, we don't know how long the trend has been present. It may have been there for 10 years. It may have been there just a few weeks. The longer the trend is present, the more likely the symptom is present or the disease is present. Copper, high copper, is a trend for cancer. High copper is associated with angiogenesis, or formation of new blood vessels when tumors metastasize and grow. We don't know, though, when you see a high copper, whether it's been there for a month or for 10 years. So it's not possible to say, and it'd be totally irresponsible to say to someone, you have high copper, therefore you have cancer, or even that you are likely to have cancer. That's not the same thing. A trend means it's an indicator that if this continues long enough, that this condition may develop. And especially when there are several indicators on hair analysis for a particular condition. For example, cadmium poisoning, high cadmium, is another indicator for cancer. A low sodium-potassium ratio, especially less than 1:1, is another indicator for malignancy. So if you see all those things together, well, then you have a better idea, a stronger trend, but still not a diagnosis, certainly, for that condition. So that's what a research association or a trend is. It's a very important concept in predictive medicine, predictive and preventive medicine. Hair analysis is a predictive and preventive tool. It's one of the things that I wish the medical profession used more of, because it would save billions and billions of dollars. We wait, in the medical profession, we wait until people are diagnosed with a disease. You know, until they walk in and they can hardly walk and you do a blood test and they got diabetes or something. That's a silly way to do things. It'd be like servicing an airplane when the engine goes out in midair. You know, it's not the way to do it. It's very expensive. So this is a predictive and preventive tool. Okay. Another question that comes up is whether hair analysis is legal and approved and all that sort of thing. The answer is absolutely. The hair analysis laboratories in the United States are licensed by CLIA. That's the federal licensing law under CLIA. And they are inspected annually. They are given blind samples. It's a little vial of, you know, a liquid. And they have to return that to the government every year. And if it doesn't measure up, in other words, if the results are not accurate, they're shut down. And they have many, many requirements to fulfill about personnel and cleanliness and all the other things that licensed laboratories have to do. There was actually a court case that showed it was legal, but it certainly is legal and licensed by the government. Another question that is frequently asked is, why do different hair analysis laboratories interpret the test differently? The reason for this has to do with the washing, for one thing. And the fact that, in other words, their readings are very different. And when you have low sodium and potassium readings, many of the labs will tell you they're just not very meaningful, and that's true. Because once you start washing, you wash out minerals erratically. You cannot predict often the amount that will be washed out. So they'll tell you that. They'll tell you, oh, the sodium potassium readings are really useless. And very well-respected people in the holistic field, such as Jonathan Wright and Jeffrey Bland, subscribe to that perspective that the sodium-potassium readings are not very useful on a hair analysis. However, you know, that's because they are using laboratories that wash the hair. We find that the sodium-potassium readings are important, they're vital, and very good, only if you do not wash the hair. The other reason a number of labs interpret the test differently is because they are not using the metabolic typing and the oxidation rates, stages of stress, and this kind of method of interpretation, which was really pioneered by Dr. Paul Ek. So I've called Doctors Data and Great Smokies and spoken to their consultants, and they don't mention any of that. They just talk about what we call replacement therapy. Replacement therapy is, oh, your zinc is low, I think you ought to take some zinc, and your calcium's a little low, and maybe you ought to take some calcium. That kind of approach, that's called replacement therapy, and Dr. Ek found very early on that it doesn't work very well. And actually, I had given up on hair testing. I did it many years ago, and it didn't work very well, and that's what I was doing. It was a Doctor's Data test, and I just decided, well, it's just another one of those new fad tests, and it'll just pass away. Okay, so those are some reasons why different laboratories interpret it differently, is their understanding is very different. Now, what does the hair test have to do with metabolic typing and oxidation types? This is a concept that Dr. George Watson pioneered. He wrote a book in 1972 called Nutrition and Your Mind, and he wrote another book a couple of years later called Psychochemical Energy and Personality Strength. And in it, he found he was not using hair testing. He was using smell testing, believe it or not. He had a number of vials with different substances, and he found that some people responded very well to certain ones and then couldn't stand the smell of other things. And they divided themselves into two groups, which he then ran blood tests and other tests to try to figure out what was the difference. And he eventually, first they were called type 1 and type 2, and then he called them fast and slow oxidizers. And his theory was that it had to do with carbohydrate and fat metabolism and the Krebs cycle and the glycolysis cycle. And his books are very informative and easy to read. They're out of print, but they're often around. It was a popular book, I guess, in used bookstores. And Dr. Paul Ek used this concept and figured out how to assess it from hair analysis. He tried a number of methods and eventually came up with the ratios, a couple of ratios. He found that the calcium-potassium ratio was one of them, and that when that ratio was more than about 4, that was an indicator of slow oxidation. When it was less than 4, it was an indication of fast. And the sodium-magnesium ratio, and that when that ratio was greater than 4.17, that was another indication of fast oxidation, and when it was less, it was more an indication of slow. So if you get a hair test from analytical research labs, it will be printed at the bottom of the page according to those ratios. You don't have to calculate them. It's done for you. If it's a fast, slow, or what they call mixed, which is if one ratio is fast and one ratio indicates slow. And Dr. Ek called the calcium-potassium ratio the thyroid ratio and the sodium-magnesium the adrenal ratio. Now, those are approximate. In other words, the reason for that is that the thyroid gland lowers calcium. That's one of the things the thyroid does. Also, potassium sensitizes the tissue to thyroid hormone. Whereas the reason the sodium magnesium was called adrenal is because aldosterone produced by the adrenal glands retains sodium. So when you have a higher sodium, you tend to have greater levels of aldosterone or greater adrenal activity. Now, these things are not going to give you the same readings as a blood test. And this is confusing too. The reason for that is that it's a tissue test. And what it's telling you is the cellular effect of the hormones. In other words, when you get a blood test for your thyroid, you're measuring hormones, circulating hormones, which is fine and gives you some information. However, the hair test is measuring something else. The hair test is a cellular test, and it measures the cellular effect of the hormones. I won't go into any more detail on this because we have so much more to cover. It's covered on tapes about adrenals and thyroid, for example. Okay, so anyway, oxidation rate can be measured on a hair test or something like that. It has more to do with yin and yang, and it has to do with stage of stress, oxidation rate. These things overlap somewhat. Dr. Watson had a very specific definition. We're using the term a little bit differently, but it's the same concept. Okay. Next question, what is meant by the mineral system? This is another very important idea if you're going to interpret to hair tests. And basically, the mineral system is a concept that William Albrecht came up with. He was a soil scientist at the University of Missouri dealing with soil. And what he found was that the minerals in the soil affect each other. The levels of the minerals affect each other. If you raise one, it lowers something else. If you raise certain ones, it raises certain other ones. They interact. Either they antagonize or they synergize. And so that's what's meant by the mineral system. And that's very important for hair analysis interpretation. We do not use replacement therapy because you give a certain mineral, such as zinc, and it will lower the sodium. Well, maybe you don't want to lower the sodium, so then you have to give something else and to raise the sodium. That's the basic idea. So that is discussed. That's more on interpretation. I won't go into more detail, but that's what's meant by the mineral system, is that all the minerals affect each other and they antagonize and synergize each other. Okay, the next concept we're going to talk about is the stress theory of disease. This was originated by Dr. Hans Selye, MD, and he wrote a book called The Stress of Life, and it's talked about a lot. Everybody talks about being under stress, but what do they mean by this? Well, Dr. Selye came up with three stages of stress: alarm, resistance, and exhaustion. He basically shocked rats, and then he dissected them at each stage, and he found, until they died, basically, after exhaustion. And he found the biochemistry was associated with each stage, and all sorts of physiological effects that happened with the adrenal glands and other things. The whole thing was called the general adaptation syndrome. And it's really revolutionary work that has not found its way into modern medicine because they don't have a way to measure this stuff. But the hair analysis gives us a way to do this. And we can distinguish if a person is in the alarm stage, the resistance stage, the exhaustion stage. And there's a chemistry associated with each one, and there are nutrients that are needed for each stage. And we move people from a lower energy stage or a sicker stage to a higher energy stage. That's a primary goal of mineral balancing or nutritional balancing science. So that's how it relates, and it has to do with the oxidation rate. Basically, the fast oxidizers are in an alarm stage. The very slow oxidizers are in the exhaustion stage of stress. Most people, unfortunately, are in the exhaustion stage of stress. So that concept is a very important one for the interpretation of a hair mineral analysis. Okay. Now, another question that gets raised very often is, why pay attention to mineral ratios? In other words, it's hard enough to figure out all these levels and what they mean, and then all of a sudden we're talking about mineral ratios and mineral patterns. Well, the reason is because ratios represent relationships, and actually health is a matter of balance. As anyone knows from other sciences like acupuncture and energy balancing and other things, balance is a very important concept. And even in human physiology, you have extension and flexion. You have dilation and contraction of vessels. You have high blood sugar and low blood sugar. Balance is very important. And ratios represent those balances. And so what Dr. Eck found was that the ratios are more important than the levels. Well, we're getting to the end of this side of this tape. So at this point, it's time to move on and move to tape 2 of this hair analysis questions and answers series.